Greetings and salutations, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this March 2011 Science News Update. I'm your host for this evening of wondrous science gossip, Jim Campanella. Let's get on with this. First, a correction and apology to all you material scientists out there. I really thought that transparent aluminum was a thing only believed in by very confused Trekkies. I was wrong. As was pointed out to me and everyone else by GAM655 on the Starship Sofa forum, there is transparent aluminum. It was invented by the military to replace bulletproof glass, which is certainly not all that bulletproof. Transparent aluminum is apparently a clear ceramic material that can stop a round from an anti-aircraft gun. It's about half as heavy and thick as bullet-resistant glass, and apparently much, much tougher. Right now, just like the superglass that we talked about last month, this aluminum is not in great use simply because it's so expensive, and it costs about $15 per square inch to produce. But it's out there. Thanks again to YAM655. I'm still amazed that this stuff exists at all. Well, here is a strange story that was reported at the February 23rd annual meeting of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences. Yes, the CSI folks. Now, I have seen lots of bad crime movies and read equally as many crime potboilers, and inevitably, in the worst of these, a la Harvey Keitel as the cleaner in the American Nikita film, Point of No Return, when somebody wants to get rid of a body completely, they take gallons of sulfuric acid and try to dissolve it. Apparently, court witnesses who have testified against the Sicilian Mafia have attested that this method works to dissolve bodies within minutes. Unfortunately, according to forensic researcher Dr. Massimo Grillo of the University of Palermo in Italy, that isn't true. Quote, "It is impossible that they completely destroyed a corpse with acid," unquote, he said. Experiments conducted on partial pig carcasses, a widely accepted stand-in for human bodies, showed that it takes days to melt flesh in sulfuric acid. Adding water to the acid speeds up the process, dissolving muscle and cartilage within 12 hours and turning bone to dust within a couple of days, suggesting that the technique could render a corpse completely unrecognizable. Police did find tanks of acid in a Palermo Mafia hideout known as the Chamber of Death, where crime boss Filippo Marchese purportedly dissolved victims after torturing them in the early 1980s. Informants had described the disposal method, the researchers say, with statements like, and oh, I'm going to break my accent rule because these are mob guys, not scientists. "We put the people in acid. In 15 to 20 minutes, they were no more. They became a liquid," unquote. Even though when the sulfuric acid was diluted in exact ratios with water, it could degrade the pig bodies much faster, Dr. Grillo says he does not believe that the mafiosi would spend the time discovering such a fact and actually performing research into the best experimental conditions to break down a body in acid. I guess that the research suggests that the members of this little crime clan were not as good at telling time as they were at ritual murders. But apparently there are criminals who are even stupider than that. Michael Henninger, an Atlanta medical examiner, said, "Those mafiosa are still smarter than some of our Georgia criminals. People think they will destroy a body, but they do purely dumb things that actually preserve the body. At least these Italian guys are more experienced." It isn't obvious whether the new research will translate into something usable for future investigations. Again, Henninger said, quote, "We constantly see cases that are weird. I'm never going to see this exact case, but when you do see something weird like this, it gets you to thinking about how you would figure it out," unquote. Well, months ago, I reported on evidence that suggested that cell phones may cause brain cancer. That report was a bit controversial because of its statistical nature, and the jury is still out on it. However, there's new evidence, and this is much more solid, that cell phones may affect brain metabolism, and that some sort of metabolic alteration occurs in the brain when phones are pressed to ears. A brain scanning study was published February 22nd in the Journal of the American Medical Association by bioengineer Dr. Henry Lai of the University of Washington. He has stated on his studies that, quote, "This is the first paper that really shows that there are changes in the brain and that talking on a cell phone pressed to your ear is really not safe," unquote. In the study, Dr. Lai's research group measured the brain activity of 47 participants who had pairs of Samsung cell phones strapped to their heads on each side. The phone on the left ear was turned off, while the one on the right received a 15-minute recorded message. The active phone was kept muted so that the subject didn't know which phone was on, and also to prevent stimulation of the brain's hearing center. A few minutes after the call, a PET scanner revealed that the brain regions next to the working phone had higher levels of glucose metabolism. The left side of the brain where the inactive phone was strapped showed no changes. Since active brain cells require glucose, the increase suggests that cell phone radiation is boosting brain activity. The human brain is sensitive to electromagnetic radiation that's emitted from cell phones. Well, that appears very obvious now. The particular brain regions affected would probably change depending on a phone's design and how a person holds it, the study says. On the phones used in the study, the antennas are near the bottom, so the brain areas involved were the orbital frontal region, which sits right behind the eyes, and the temporal pole below it. Glucose metabolism rose in these areas by about 7%, an increase typically seen when the brain regions become active. For example, glucose metabolism in the language areas of the brain rises about 10% when a person is talking. The increase in brain metabolism observed in the experiments may be an underestimate because cell phones emit even more radiation when a person is actually talking, says Lai. Radiation levels also change depending on the cell phone type, the distance to the nearest cell phone tower, and the number of people using the phones in the same area. All these variables have prevented scientists from getting good epidemiological data about potential health risks of cell phone usage. Researchers don't know yet whether cell phone radiation is dangerous. Quote, at this point, we do not know what clinical significance this particular finding is, unquote, says the paper. The heightened activity may not have any ill effects, or it may be very dangerous, particularly with years of heavy cell phone use or in the developing brains of children and teens. The paper suggests that if you are worried about chatting on your cell phone, that there are a couple of easy solutions that don't cost anything for those who want to play it safe. For instance, people can just limit their use of the cell phone, use the speakerphone option, or talk with a hands-free device that's connected to the phone with a wire. Considering how addicted younglings seem to be at present to cell phone use, I really worry about future findings in this area, especially those directed at teens and young kids. The next story explains, at least in part, why humans were able to kick Neanderthals to the evolutionary roadside, well, so to speak. It appears that Neanderthals, besides not understanding how to buy decent car insurance, also couldn't run very well for any distance. A new study reports that Stone Age humans, unlike their Neanderthal contemporaries, had heel bones spring-loaded for long runs. Dr. David Raiklin of the University of Arizona and his colleagues published a paper January 26th in the Journal of Human Evolution that addresses the problems that Neanderthals probably had running. According to Raiklin, Neanderthals could power walk because of the backs of their feet, but out-and-out running was not in the cards for them. In ancient Homo sapiens, as in people today, a short lower heel stretched the Achilles tendon taut. That arrangement increased the tendon's spring-like action during running and reduced energy consumption, enabling extended runs or excursions. The result coincides with an earlier proposal that bodies suited to endurance running evolved in the genus Homo more than 2 million years ago because they aided hunting and carcass scavenging before spears were in widespread use. And that was maybe about 400,000 years ago. Raiklin's team also found that Neanderthals, compared to people today, had tall heel bones that put less energy-efficient spring in their steps while running. Neanderthals' tall heels possibly stabilized their ankles, giving them an advantage over Homo sapiens in walking up hills and in jumping, though, the paper hypothesizes. Raiklin says, quote, we can say that energy costs of running differed between Neanderthals and modern humans, but our data don't really speak to the question of what happened to the Neanderthals. Scientists already knew that relative to Stone Age people, Neanderthals weighed more, had shorter legs, and had smaller inner ear canals that would have affected the balance needed to coordinate body movements, all obstacles to endurance running. Raiklin's study just provides more evidence that Neanderthals were not as adept at long-distance running as humans. Reasons why modern humans evolved to run farther than Neanderthals are unclear, the paper explains. running prey to exhaustion may have worked better on hot African savannas where Homo sapiens lived than in the cold European settings inhabited by Neanderthals. But no heel fossils have been unearthed for any other Homo species, making it impossible to determine exactly when running, friendly, spring-loaded feet like those of modern humans first evolved. You are going to have to forgive me if this next story sounds kind of vague and not very conclusive, but that's exactly what it is. And unfortunately, that condition may not change very soon. A fellow scientist of mine pointed out the story to me, since I am not an avid birder. It appears that many populations of birds in the northern areas of North America have been found with deformities whose origins are very difficult to explain. In a recent pair of papers in the ornithology journal The Auk, Drs. Colleen Handel, Carolyn Van Hemmert, and colleagues from the U.S. Geological Survey reported deformed beaks turning up among crows in British Columbia and Washington, and more than 2,100 deformed black-capped chickadees have been found in Alaska since 1998. Additionally, a few deformed red-tailed hawks have been seen as far south as California. Now, all these birds look very strange, and when I first saw a photo of them, not being a bird person, I thought the birds looked like they belonged in some tropical jungle sipping at flowers. In place of their typical snub-nosed bills, deformed chickadees, for example, have thick, arched, crow-like beaks and crescent-shaped bills that remind you of birds that do sip at flowers, like honey creepers. Those are the deformed birds that look normal if you don't know any better. There are also birds that have bizarrely crossed mandibles. Well, these deformities can be a serious threat to survival. It causes problems for eating and for preening for the affected birds. The mystery is what causes the deformities. The birds have been tested for the most obvious offenders, bacterial and viral pathogens, and researchers have come up absolutely negative. They've ruled out also some sort of genetic problem because the birds that are being affected are older and are not born with the defects. A bird's beak consists of bone overlaid by a horny structure. That horny material is keratin, the same protein that makes up hair and feathers and fingernails and claws. Like nails, that horny structure constantly grows and wears away. The deformities are a result of that growth suddenly accelerating, in some cases to nearly twice as fast as anybody has ever measured before. The underlying bones show no evidence of abnormality. Scientists have hypothesized that it's some sort of environmental contaminant that's causing the disorder, which they are now calling avian keratin disorder. The only problem with the environmental contaminant hypothesis is that some of these birds do not travel very far, and yet birds separated by long distances of hundreds of miles have shown the deformities. Worse, the cases are spread across such a wide area, including some fairly unspoiled places, that it's really hard to identify a likely contaminant. The papers state that across coastal and interior Alaska, an average of 6.5% of black-capped chickadees now show these deformities. Across a smaller range of six sites, which spans about 550 miles, an average of 16.7% of northwestern crows were affected. These percentages are like massively high. Other deformity spikes that have been observed in the past, including cormorants that were affected by organochlorines and selenium in the Great Lakes during the 1970s and 80s, even those topped out at about 3.5%. So what's going on here? Nobody knows. This is a serious mystery. The U.S. Geological Survey has begun a collaboration with Project Feedwatch in the hopes of helping to pinpoint the geographic limits of the disorder. They encourage anyone who sees a deformed bird anywhere to report it to the USGS website, www.bit.ly/deformedbirds. I'll repeat that, www.bit.ly/deformedbirds. So if you see a deformed bird, drop a dime, like they used to say when phone calls actually costed a dime, and you may be able to help solve this conundrum. The last two stories of the night are about, wait for it, yes, ants! I know you guys have just been pining for more ant stories. So the first ant story piles more worldwide guilt upon America, as if we haven't garnered enough of that in the last 10 years or so. Genetic evidence now spotlights the United States as the source of recent fire ant invasions to the rest of the world. Dr. Kenneth Ross of the University of Georgia in Athens reported in the February 25th issue of the journal Science that the U.S. has turned into a bridgehead as a forefront to ant invasions across the world. The aggressive stinging fire ant, Selenopsis invicta, aren't native to the United States, but rather to a broad swath of South America. Yet the southern United States, invaded by the fire ants in the 1930s, has sent off at least 8 separate waves of fire ant invasions to other countries in recent years. Ross reports that these waves of ants are now colonizing the Caribbean, Australia, New Zealand, Taiwan, and China, including Hong Kong and Macau. Ross suggests that, quote, this study is going to cause quite a stir. It could have important trade and travel implications, unquote. Frankly, it doesn't matter what the political fallout is going to be. The study is a valuable step in dealing with this problem. Scientists need to know how invasions spread in order to be able to prevent them and effectively manage these invasions. To track the invasions, an international research team analyzed ants from 2,144 colonies in a total of 75 places in 11 countries and looked at several kinds of genetic information, including dozens of DNA genetic markers. The study indicated that the fire ants in their native range of South America have about 322 distinct genetic types. Only 11 of those genetic types are found in the United States, including 3 that are very rare in the native range. Yet the populations from newly invaded territories had combinations of the 3 rare variants from the U.S. types and not the others left behind in South America. Additionally, the researchers ran computer models of how gene patterns change in populations as invaders butt off into new territories. The scenarios that fit the data best show that the United States is the source. This analysis raises the possibility that the rigors of invading the U.S. and then moving on toward world domination have winnowed out the weaklings and less invasive ants. Populations now erupting from the United States could be especially adapted as super invaders. I can't say that I find that as a pleasant thought. These ants are not only hard to kill off entirely, but they have some serious tricks for surviving even environmental catastrophes. In the ants' native ranges, they survive flooding by fleeing their nests with their young and gripping each other to create living rafts of ants that float until the flood subsides. And if they're afloat for longer than they can survive without food, the adults eat the young. This ability to survive starvation allows fire ants to endure days or even weeks as international stowaways in just about any kind of cargo. For shorter distance travel, young fire ant queens fly off to find mates, and they may end up wafting onto trucks or other ground transportation that take the queens on detours. Ross says, another frightening statistic, that they collected 5,000 queens in a parking lot in one afternoon. The last story of the night is about another invading ant species that has proven intractable. I have spoken of crazy ants before and how they are such a serious issue in Oceania, where they have taken over entire islands. Well, this story explains why the crazy ants are so darn robust. Anybody who has ever taken basic biology knows that incest is a bad thing for brothers and sisters because, if we just ignore the cultural taboo, there's a very good chance of reinforcing serious recessive genetic traits and endangering the lives of the offspring. This, by the way, is one of the historical problems that the Ptolemies had in Egypt as rulers. Because the pharaohs were gods, they could only marry their brothers and sisters, who were also gods. Anyway, a new report tells us that crazy ants uniquely have the ability to mate with siblings with no genetic problems ensuing. Dr. Morgan Piercy of the Free University of Brussels reports in the recent issue of the Proceedings of the Royal Society that this amazing power has probably helped the crazy ant become one of the most widespread invasive ants in all the tropics. The tiny ants with long antennae were nicknamed crazy ants because they dash along erratically instead of following foraging trails. They now occupy so much of the tropics that scientists haven't figured out even where they originated. Unlike the fire ants, longhorn crazy ants don't bite or sting people, but they forage far and fast and can track pathogens from trash to table. They are in food, they are in cabinets, Hospitals in particular dread them because they have become a major source of infection spread. Piercy says, when you order a pizza, yes, they can be in the pizza. The way that the process works is still a mystery, but Piercy discovered that there are three castes being produced through different means. The worker class is developed through normal sexual reproduction between queens and males. However, the queens are produced clonally and thus are genetically identical to their mothers. Now, the new finding is that the male offspring in the ant colony are clones of the father, with no genetic input from the female queen. So the upshot is that brothers and sisters do not share genetic material. Hence, they can continue to mate without accruing recessives. It boggles the mind because this system has been completely unknown until this point. Piercy has hypothesized that some trait of the queens lets them produce empty eggs with none of the queen's DNA in them at all. So when the sperm reaches them, they become clones of the father. But again, how this occurs has still not exactly been determined. It is hoped that by better understanding their process of reproduction, we have a better chance of controlling these little pests. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care. Watch out for those birds with the deformed beaks, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.